to the IPv6 Buzz podcast, where we dare to dive into the 128-bit address space wormhole. I'm Ed Horley with my co-host Tom Coffeen, and Scott Hoag is not able to join us today, but instead, we seem to have managed to wrangle some really cool packet pusher folks to come along and join us. So we've got, as our guests, you know, Drew and Ethan for the packet pushers, which we're really excited about. And we're going to be talking sort of through, you know, the Tom got invited to do the packet pushers post-virtual design clinic, and he was talking about IPv6 and address planning. And we wanted to sort of, you know, jump into some questions because we didn't get enough time in that show to actually hear everything that Tom wanted to share. So I wanted to have Ethan and Drew on to sort of ask a bunch of follow-up questions in regards to sort of address planning and what's going on with all of that. So Ethan, Drew, welcome.
Yeah, thanks for having us on. Yeah. So what happened to poor Tom, we were having the virtual design clinic, which is a live event, and there's limits on the amount of time people can present. Tom had a 45-minute slot. We got to like 42 minutes and he had like a whole case study yet to go and points to make. It's like, oh man. So we could not finish all of that material. And if you actually watch that presentation, which is up on YouTube, just search for Tom Coffeen and IPv6 address planning. You'll find it on YouTube on the first page of Google results. The the last several slides is like click, 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 click. He's done in like 5 seconds. So
sorry, guys. I get so excited, you know. It's just fails to use time wisely was, you know, what I used to see on my elementary school report card. So still the case today.
It is what it is. But we have this show as an excuse to ask some follow-up questions. And, you know, for me, I had this moment as I was watching your presentation back, Tom, about nibbles. You talked a lot about the nibbles, nibble boundary, subnetting an IPv6 on the nibble boundary. And I think a lot of it came together. So for my sake, again, let's say there's people who are familiar with bits, you know, 8 bits in a byte. So we know bits, we know bytes, but if nibbles, we haven't got our brain around it yet. What's a nibble?
A nibble is 4 bits.
It's just that simple, isn't it? 4 bits. That a nibble is 4 bits. Okay. Now you had stressed in the presentation, subnetting on the nibble boundary, on the 4-bit boundary. And I had this epiphany where it all started to come together for me. So give us an example here of a V6 network subnet that's not on the nibble boundary, so a bad subnet, one that we don't really want to work with when we're doing IPv6 address planning, versus a network that would be a good subnet, one that is on the nibble boundary.
Yeah, of course. I'm happy to do it. Yeah. And thanks again for inviting me to the Virtual Design Clinic in the first place and the opportunity to give this, you know, the presentation around address planning. I'm glad we're having this follow-up. This is one of those concepts that I think you really hit the nail on the head, Ethan. It's like once you grasp it and you see the power of it, the simplicity of it, it really changes the way that you're going to approach your address plan and your overall sort of network design. And so, with the nibble, the reason why it's significant, and so we talk about 4 bits, but we don't want to really, we have to get a little more specific because we can, you know, since we could start a nibble theoretically away from a multiple of 4 bits, like if I look, you know, into a V6 address where I have 128 bits, when I talk about nibbles, I'm really talking about, you know, all of the bits that are divisible by factors of 4. So, you know, I want to make sure that that's clear when I talk about what a nibble boundary is. So it has to be, you know, one of those clean 4-bit groups that, you know, I could divide 32 by in my 128-bit address. And the reason why that ends up being significant in our address is that every one of those nibbles represents a character in the hexadecimal address. And so initially that doesn't seem particularly compelling. You're just like, well, okay, yeah, duh, it's hexadecimal, 4 bits equals a character in the address. But then when you start getting into subnetting, you get this really powerful representational aspect of IPv6, where if I stick to that nibble boundary, it means that whatever boundary that is, I can make it significant for where it gets assigned. And so that's where we get into the idea of like good, you know, a good group of subnets based on a nibble boundary and quote unquote, a bad group of subnets not based on a nibble boundary. And so I want to point out that in early days where we're at with IPv6, you know, we want to take advantage of this nibble boundary concept as much as we can, because it does simplify our address planning as I'll sort of talk through here in a second. But over time, it's very likely that we'll end up sort of, you know, naturally moving away and taking advantage of those bit boundaries as we have to sort of number into the space that we're not sort of using initially by sticking to this nibble boundary. But so just to get back to your initial question, the example of like a good nibble boundary, so a slash 48 is a prefix that we pick on a lot in IPv6, and it's sort of the midline between a larger allocation that we're going to give like a big enterprise or a service provider and the slash 60, which is usually a slash 32, and a slash 64 that actually goes on a LAN or a WAN interface. So it's right in the middle, you know, 16 bits in either direction. So a slash 48, you know, if we use the documentation prefix, we'll say the 2001 colon DB8 colon, and then I'll just pick on say 1000 as a prefix. And I say that's a slash 48. And so double colon slash 48 with the CIDR notation, that's like indicating a single slash 48 prefix. Now, if I go ahead and move to the bit to the right of that, and I'm actually subnetting that 48 into two slash 49s, something happens where I end up with that same prefix, 2001 colon DB8 colon 1000. And then I've got basically two blocks of 49s. I've got two 49s rather, but then that boils down into additional blocks of prefixes. And I'm figuring out what that is by having to divide that character that comes right after 1000 colon. So the first half of it would be 0 through 7, and the second half of it would be 8 through F. And so then I have to look at that character and sort of decide where I've actually made that, you know, which of those groups of subnets that I'm actually looking at.
The point being, in this slash 49 example, that's ugly, and we're having to do thinking and breaking up of the address space in a way that is not easy for our human minds to complex. The computer could care less from a standpoint of it's really all binary at that level. But for us, just trying to break the subnets for IPv6 up in a way that's easy for us to keep up with, as soon as we start breaking things not on the nibble boundary and have to do that computation and figure out where a particular subnet begins and ends, it's hard. It's kind of like when you're working with IPv4 and you do a slash 24, that's easy. You do a slash 25, you got to think about it a lot more.
Exactly. That's exactly right. And if we're using some sophisticated tools to track addresses and subnets, you might say, well, big deal. You know, if I'm using IPAM, for instance, and I'm plugging all these prefixes into an IPAM database and I'm using that as sort of my single source of truth, well, I don't know what networks, you know, someone's had the privilege to work on where that's actually all cleaned up and working and operative with IPAM. In general, we see a lot of, you know, instances where there's a lot of sources of truth, and you never quite know if you're looking at the right source of information for what a prefix is and where it lives. But it really boils down to, if it's, you know, it's the 3 o'clock in the morning troubleshooting exercise, right? If I have to log onto the router and I have to look at a group of subnets, and you know, my brain isn't working that great at that time of the morning, and and I know if I've got, you know, or at least mine doesn't. I don't know. I can't speak for other folks, but you know, if I know I'm looking at a network that is carved up along nibble boundaries, whenever I look at a particular character, you know, if it's relevant to where a particular route summarization is, or where a particular security group is, or has been assigned a particular group of, you know, an ACL that applies to a particular security region or zone, or if I know that a particular building has been assigned a prefix and it falls on that nibble boundary, it just gets rid of a lot of ambiguity that allows me to do troubleshooting based on, you know, some relatively stripped down information fairly quickly. And I should take advantage of that while I can, when I'm doing my address plan. You know, if I can make sure that things fall on nibble boundaries, it gives me this opportunity then to clean up, you know, help keep the troubleshooting process as simple as possible.
Is that then the primary benefit of subnetting on the nibble boundary, that it's just more human understandable, or are there other reasons to do it?
Yeah, legibility is the primary one. The other benefit is that we're baking into our address plan a lot of unused space by sticking to the nibble boundary. Mm-hmm. We made sure by, you know, leaving 4 bits in between, that down the road, if we decide, hey, I've got this location and I assigned this prefix to it, and I use that nibble boundary, and the next prefix that I assigned was along the nibble boundary, that means that I've left 4 bits in between that I can number into within that space, within that location, whatever it is. It might be a location, it might be a function. You know, there's different ways to think about how you're going to assign prefixes, but, you know, just the classic network example, it just represents, you know, that subnet represents a network, and that's probably a physical network somewhere, a physical location. Mm-hmm. Well, I've left myself bits in reserve that I can number into down the road. And so, of course, at that point, I'm moving away from the nibble boundary and doing what we did with, you know, Ethan mentioned a moment ago, the classic, you know, hey, it'd be great if I could throw a slash 24 at everything and be done. But then, of course, we end up with slash 25s and 26s and et cetera. We're using VLSM. And eventually maybe I end up in the same place with V6 if I have to number into those additional bits, but it's there for me to use. And that's one of the additional benefits besides just the operational, you know, efficiency and the additional legibility of the address as I build my address plan.
The epiphany that I had, Tom, as I was watching your presentation back from the virtual design clinic was when you subnet a V6 address on the nibble boundary, and you just mentioned this a moment ago, you're working with a character in the address, and that, like, you're never splitting that character into, well, somewhere in the middle here, you know, the subnet breaks and I got to figure out where that is. You're working with that one character. And when that hit me, like, okay, I get it now. This is so much easier. And 'cause then, as you said, now you can make these location specific address plans, or you could map a group of networks to a set of VLANs, let's say, in a logical way that makes sense. And once we get over the fact that we are, quote unquote, wasting addresses, because from a V6 standpoint, there really is no such thing as wasting address space. You just build your address plan for legibility. Wow, you know, the opportunity to get it right and get it clean and you know, deploying V6 is actually an opportunity to start over, since every place I've been with a V4 address plan that started with good intentions, it always breaks down. It never really works out in the long run.
Realistically, one of the things that Tom's leaving out that maybe I think is another huge advantage about the nibble side is, and maybe Tom can elaborate on this, was some of the fixed automatic sizing configurations that you get that become very repetitive in terms of the design aspects of laying out a prefix. And I don't know, Tom, if that makes sense to sort of talk about, like, hey, you got 16, 256, right? And like the natural inclination of how you build networks to allocate for how many networks.
And yeah, I mean, that you could see that as the reason that I didn't mention it explicitly. It probably has to do with the fact that that can either be seen as something that's like powerful, or it can be seen as a limitation. And it's generally regarded, and what Ed is referring, I think what you're referring to is with the nibble boundary, you end up with multiples of subnets based on that nibble math. And so the natural sort of expansion of that, you know, decimally is 16, 256, 4,096, and 65,536. And then you can go up from there. But generally, you know, we use that group of four numbers to sort of decide where in the network we're making decisions about what constitutes, you know, what size of a group of prefixes we're going to assign. So like you mentioned the VLAN scenario, you know, and I think that if you wanted to sort of get, you know, super OCD about things and you wanted to assign a VLAN identifier to a particular prefix, you would need at least, you know, if you have a 48 per site, which is the general rule, you would need at least a 52 because you've got 4,096 slash 64s within one single 52. So you notice that I use that group of 4,096 and I have to, every time I move to, you know, the next nibble, either in either direction, I'm sort of going in one direction or the other from 16 to 256 to 4096 to 65K or in the opposite direction. And so that gives you, there's some power there in that you can make decisions about, you know, what size group you're dealing with, whatever the entity happens to be, if it's a group of VLANs, if it's a group of buildings, you know, if it's a group of physical networks or a group of ACL entries, whatever it might be, you're sort of making that decision based on those sort of very ungranular buckets of a decimally expanded nibbles. But the reason that's, you have to get to the point where, as you mentioned, Ethan, you really get past the concept of waste, because when you do that jump, like a, you know, it's kind of maybe a little easy to think about going from 16 to 256 or maybe less of a stretch. And then when you go from 256 to 4,096 and you're like, wow, you know, I've got 300 things that I need to put subnets on and I'm going to assign the next nibble up. And that gives me 4,000 like, you know, I have 4,000 prefixes available for 300 things. And then, you know, that's where, if you're still in the clutches of the fear and the anxiety that goes with wasting address space, that's where you're going to break out into a cold sweat and freak out and then start subnetting on the bit boundary. And you're going to ruin your opportunity to take advantage of this incredibly powerful, you know, technique of forcing the nibble, as it
and
were.
I think that ties back to a lot of what you were covering in your VDC presentation, was getting out of the IPv4 mindset, which is about scarcity and preservation, and into this V6 mindset where scarcity isn't an issue, so you can do things like, you know, design for legibility, for human legibility.
Yeah, exactly. And again, the whole idea of wasting, or, you know, over consuming, or whatever it might be, It breaks down in two domains within IPv6. It breaks down the first domain, which is probably the easier one to deal with, is the host address preservation, which, you know, we talked about the /24 example in V4. That's the classic scenario where it's like, man, I can't afford to waste these, you know, these host addresses. And so I am going to put 2/25s. I'm going to carve out 2/25s from this /24. So I'm not wasting address space, but specifically not wasting host address space. And that's in IPv6, that's probably the easier one to get over, because if I think about, hey, I'm putting a /64 on an interface, who cares? It's 1.8 times 10 to the 19th addresses. They're just, you know, that train left the station when it was designed to be 128-bit address space, of which 64 bits were assigned to the interface identifier. So the plan, the original designers of IPv6 were basically, you know, they were throwing that sort of gauntlet down initially to say, you can't possibly be concerned about wasting host addresses here, because we're giving you 1.8 times 10 to the 19th per interface. And so that one's a little easier to get over. It's that when you start thinking about subnet consumption, which is the real measure of IPv6 address consumption, that's a little harder to get over, because the next step is getting to that place where you're comfortable with asking for more address space, where you're comfortable moving the boundary to the left instead of to the right. So instead of subnetting ever more granularly, I'm actually just getting a larger address block. I'm getting myself more bits to number into. And I'm able to do that because the regional internet registries have a policy that allows for that. It's like, basically, what do you need operationally? If you decide you need another nibble or another two nibbles of subnets, we're going to give you those. You know, if that's what you've determined will make your network operationally efficient.
Tom, I got this actually is a good segue into a specific question I had about point-to-point links, which we did touch on in the VDC presentation a bit, but I just wanted to expand on that and get your take. So on a point-to-point link, where typically I would just have two addresses, the routers on either end of that point-to-point link, in the V4 world, I would probably do that as a /30 or maybe a 31. In V6, I could do it as a /64 that just has these two endpoints in it, or some shops do it as a /127. And in the presentation, I think you advocated for /64s, but I noticed going through the slides and the case study that we didn't actually have time to talk about, a slide showed that they were assigning /127s to the P2P links. Is there a right way, or is it, you know, what are the pros and cons of a /64 on point-to-point links versus 127s?
Yeah, it's a great question. And there's at least two sort of dimensions to the answer. And the first one is just related back to the psychology we just talked about. And I can't sort of overemphasize how difficult this is as a network engineer, because this is the first time that I came face-to-face with the size of the address space and the size of the number of available addresses in a /64, and the fact that the recommendation, you know, initially was to use two of those addresses, two out of 1.8 times 10 to the 19th. And, you know, coming from the V4 world, you're just like, this is an outrage. I can't believe somebody's recommending, you know, wasting all this space. And then, you know, once you get over that hump, it's like, okay, it doesn't really matter how many addresses I use out of this /64. So then it becomes, you know, an actual operational question as to whether or not you're going to introduce in any problems by using that larger block. And there was a period of time, and this question always comes up, and to some extent, I'm not sure how timely it is anymore. And I don't have good information from the vendors, directly from the vendors, that's more recent And part of that is that it seemed as if this problem from a technical standpoint and operational standpoint went away like several years ago, like sometime around 2009, 2010. Yeah, the platforms I was working with back then, it certainly did. And what I'm talking about specifically is because of the way V6 works, the concept of neighbor discovery, which is doesn't have really a parallel in IPv4. I mean, the closest thing is ARP, but ARP, you know, uses broadcast and it's much less sophisticated. Neighbor discovery is leveraging multicast. It's very efficient, but it comes with its own potential security challenges. And very early on in the implementation of service provider V6, it was determined that there was a vulnerability in a couple of attacks. That one was the ping pong attack between two interfaces, and the other one was the neighbor discovery cache exhaustion attack. The second one, I think, was the one that was maybe the more concerning, where you, because of the way neighbor discovery works, you ran the possibility of having this neighbor discovery consume all of the available memory that's set aside for entries to map layer 2 to layer 3. And of course, on a point-to-point interface, I should just turn neighbor discovery off. I mean, I should just really have the addresses mapped on those interfaces, and neighbor discovery shouldn't be running at all. But initially,
map them so that each side of the link can find each other, and not really have to rely on neighbor discovery to find each other.
Exactly.
And then reduce your exposure to the vulnerability.
Yeah, exactly.
If there even was one anymore.
Right. And that was where, okay, well, a workaround for this is if you just configure a /127 on the link, then you've only got the two addresses, and then, you know, you can't really leverage that attack. As a result, I think a lot of vendors, you know, pretty early on figured out that this was a vulnerability and patched it. But in the meantime, there was sort of back and forth, and it percolated up through the IETF and into an actual RFC 6164, where they sort of talk about this issue. And this dates all the way back to 2011. But I, you know, from my own perspective, working on a big service provider network, the vendor had patched this relatively early, and so I was free to use a /64 on an interface. Now, there may be some reason operationally that you prefer having a /127 for troubleshooting purposes. Maybe you always use the same, you know, this side address and the same, I'm sure I can't think of the technical word, this side and the other side. You know, I always use for my side of the point-to-point link, or for the left side of the point-to-point link on a diagram or whatever, maybe I use, you know, this particular value, and on the other side I use this other particular value, and I want that to be consistent as I'm rolling out point-to-point links. And so I'm only going to configure a /127 that sort of narrows that down. Having said that, generally you go ahead and reserve an entire /64 for just that point-to-point link. So it's not the scenario that we have.
You're not going to take a /64 and carve a bunch of 127s out of it. You're going to use unique /64s for each, even if you choose to apply a subnet mask that's /127 for those addresses.
Well, yeah, right. to be persnickety about it, not a subnet mask, but a CIDR, a prefix length.
Fair. Yes. Yes. I understand.
Well, technically.
Yeah.
Well,
actually, okay.
I
think it's important to note too that the 127 was moved to historic status. So
yeah,
it's not the community's recommendation that a 127 is necessarily the way to do it. I think they were trying to give flexibility to providers to do the right thing. That was an RFC that was really written for a point in time around, and I would say for a particular manufacturer, actually, in regards to some problems in their silicon.
Now, another question that came up on this topic during the virtual design clinic that we didn't have time to address are link local addresses. So a lot of us that have had early V6 training were exposed to, you're going to apply your link local addresses, and that's where things like neighbor relationships are going to form with routing protocols and so on. How do link local addresses fit in these days?
Yeah, it's a good question. And the answer is they're very operative in, you know, routed environments, exactly what you're describing, the forming of neighbor relationships, the use for, peering relationships in BGP, neighbor relationships in some of the IGPs, et cetera. I think that's generally recommended. We tend to sort of poo-poo the idea of security through obscurity. The idea that if I don't really know what the addresses, and somebody outside the network doesn't really know what the address is, and therefore there's, you know, additional security that sort of benefits that you get from that. You know, how you're addressing your own routing domain, your own service provider domain with a collection of routers, and how those routers are talking to each other. You see a lot of use of link local addressing for that purpose. And it, you know, it's I think it's generally recommended. I've seen many configurations where it's recommended just in terms of like larger routing domains. So,
but to be clear, if we're using link local, in your mind, is that a replacement for something I might assign out of my globally routable V6 block? Or in addition to, would I just have this as one of maybe several different V6 addresses I might have assigned to an interface?
Well, I think you have to be careful there. I mean, you know, and I don't know, Ed can weigh in here too, because he's definitely got experience in deploying larger networks and has run into this. But I think you have to be careful in terms of making sure that the service provider network and the way the addresses get assigned in the service, and well, just even in an enterprise network, a large routed domain, you know, the rules are generally the same as they are with V4, just in terms of the types of address resources that you use. I mean, I know you can have, like, obviously in an edge environment where I'm supporting host OSs or mobile devices that are connecting to a network, or desktops or laptops or whatever, the multiple address scenario comes into play. But I don't know that we really see that in routed domains. You know, where if I'm just talking about the underlying infrastructure of addressing that's there to support the routing protocols, then, you know, there's sort of one layer of addressing that gets assigned, and I might choose to use link local. I could certainly use routed address. I could certainly use global unicast allocation to do that. And I've been in network environments where I've done both. But you know, they're I don't know as far as any sort of, I can't think of any sort of caveats related to that.
Yeah, I think I'll pipe in on this.
Please do. Yeah.
These probably have stronger opinions. On the link local side, for a true network, you're going to be controlling your link local for what you establish everywhere. And you're probably going to map it to a policy that's similar to how you do router IDs. So just like you do for any routing protocol, you probably have a router ID that's associated with it. You're probably going to embed that piece of information in the link local address that's associated with the router interfaces themselves. The reason why is just for operational, you know, ease. You can look at a neighbor peer and actually be like, oh, I know that router ID. So I now know which interface that router peering is happening across. So there's operational things that you might put in there that you may or may not include in your global unicast address plan. So this is where the two may diverge a little bit. And also you may have a strategy around on the access layer for clients. You may have a strategy of saying, you know what, just operationally make my life simple. I might choose, we have customers we work with that, you know, FE80:1 is the default gateway on every single VLAN, no matter what. So, and this gets a little weird because, you know, obviously you can have duplicate address configurations if you accidentally plug two VLAN ports in across each other and you're not actually running VLAN tagging, right? You can have strange scenarios where you have that and shut down both default gateways. But the reality is that from a practical, you know, stand up implementation side, that does make life a lot easier, especially makes it easier for your downstream host to understand where their default gateway is actually located, because it's the same every single time. So those are some operational principles that might be different in the global unicast space versus the link local, which is, I think, what you're asking, Ethan, right?
You know what you guys just gave me as an answer to the question? You both just said, it depends. That's what I heard.
Well, I think that's fair. You should also keep in mind, and for the folks that aren't as familiar with V6, I mean, when you're dealing with a link local address and the difference between global unicast, you're dealing with the locally scoped, meaning, you know, if there's a hop limit on, you know, we use hop limit in IPv6, and that's set to 255. So those, whatever is going on packet wise, it can't leave that link, right? It has to stay on that link. That's not the case with a global unicast allocation address. So it's something to keep in mind. You know, if I want an additional way to constrain traffic, and, you know, if I'm dealing with point to point links, then it makes sense. I don't ever want traffic leaving that link. If I use a global unicast address on that link, you know, if I'm configuring things correctly, there's no reason to think that I'm going to see any traffic off of that link. But if there's if somebody misconfigures something, there's the possibility that I might end up with some strange behavior and have a harder time figuring it out. Whereas when I'm using link local, I know that, you know, that it's restricted to that link. And so that's beneficial potentially if I'm building a network of point-to-point links and running a routing protocol on top of it.
Here's another follow-up question for you, Tom, from your presentation. PA versus PI space, provider allocated space. I'm getting address space from my ISP. Is there ever a use case for this that you can think of? It doesn't seem like there was. It seems like I'd always want to have provider independent space that it's been assigned to me from my rear. Is there ever a time that PA space makes sense from your perspective?
Well, if you're singly, yeah, because you right off the bat, I mean, if you have more than one connection to the internet, or if you plan to have more than one connection to the internet, then you just PA's out. I mean, there's really, it's a hard challenge to get around just in terms of dealing with what we have available to us routing wise today to try to make PA work.
I guess that could be ISP dependent. I mean, I was in a scenario once where I was actually allowed to announce PA space across a different ISP and everybody was okay with this and it worked. I tested mm-hmm. it. But that I was very surprised when everyone's like, oh yeah, well, you can do that. That's fine. Really? Okay. That wasn't V6, it was V4 as it happened. But I agree, normally, right, PI space is where you want to be when you're dual homed across different ISPs. It's your own address space that you're announcing out there across those two arms.
Yeah, that's right. There are some instances where if you have, you know, if it's a very small network and you have one ISP and that's just sort of how things are and how you plan on having things in the future, you're not planning on changing ISPs, sticking to that one provider assigned block is probably okay. It really just depends. You just have to be aware of the fact that you're running the risk of having to renumber out of that space if you're using it. Whereas with PI space, you'll never have to renumber out of it. The probability that you would is incredibly low. So that in itself is probably the biggest argument and reason that, you know, you should do everything you can to get your hands on a PI block, which is not hard, of course. If it was harder, then maybe there'd be more of a sort of, you know, a thought experiment as to which is the better to use, but it's just really not hard to get PI space. Of course, the downside of that is that, you know, we're seeing a lot of disaggregation. If the /40 is the smallest routable prefix, you know, then the V6 prefix table, the DFZ is growing by leaps and bounds. But, you know, there are plenty of folks who feel like, well, it's not as if we're super constrained in terms of where we're going to end up with CPU and memory down the road. Today, we might have issues because of like TCAM allocations and routing platforms where, you know, they might be allocating a certain amount of the table, depending on what you're using routing protocol wise, a certain amount of the table's allocated to V4, some of it's left over for V6. The way it gets carved up, you could end up, you know, running into limits in terms of the number of V6 blocks. And so then the whole PI question about whether or not to use PI and the fact that, you know, if I'm using PI, I'm basically contributing to routing table disaggregation, you know, versus everything being summarized through a single service provider upstream. And, you know, I've only got whatever that PA block is, then that's another question.
Yeah, on V4, the largest block or smallest, hang on, whichever, was a /24. You couldn't right. announce anything that was more granular than a /24 for all the reasons you just described. The internet can't bear up under that kind of a load. I've lost track of just how many routes are out there. I was pushing 600,000, I think, last I knew. We were getting there. Maybe we've passed that now. I don't know. With V6, is a /48 where you're at? You can't do anything more granular than a /48?
No, right now that's the limit.
Okay.
And I think that's probably, go ahead.
Well, I think the other argument is no one cared in V4 to get all the way down to 24 and break all of our routing that way right. and get up to 600,000 routes. So I think the V6 community is like, you know, okay, well, it's proven that the routers can stand up to that. So keep at it. It's right. just the argument.
Well, there's lots it's of like, core boxes that can handle a million routes now. I know that, but still, yeah. It's fairly easy to imagine exhausting a number as tiny as a million in the scale of the global internet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree. I think the reality is, and maybe get back to the original PA versus PI space. If you're doing the right stuff with PI, you're probably not going to disaggregate down to a 48 on a regular basis. It's really going to be for those special need cases. I need the smallest block that I can do any cast with is going to be a 48, just like in V4, you're going to have to do a 24, right? in order to advertise that address range upstream for Anycast availability. Other things like that. But outside of that, I don't think you're gonna take your 32 and carve it all the way down to 48s and advertise all the 48s explicitly.
That makes sense. Yeah.
Well, it gets into the policy discussion, right? What is the policy going to be? Because we've certainly seen evolution of policy related to how V6 is handled in the DFZ. You know, over time, like initially when I first got my slash 32s at Limelight and started deploying it there, I had made sure to get a slash 32 per region that we were operating in. And I built the routing policy and the address plan around the use of that address space. And that's maybe changed, or it seems like it has changed from input I've gotten from folks that are deploying today, where there's a general consensus that out of region announcements are perfectly okay. So I could have one block from Aaron, say, and I could use that in the RIPE region or potentially a PNIC region. But these are policies that are set at the rear level, or if they're ignored at the rear level, then they can be set by particular NSPs or ISPs. And then it just really sort of depends on what people choose to do in terms of routing more, in terms of announcing more specifics, and then what, how ISPs respond to that. Over the years, we've seen a lot of sort of fishy announcements in Asia Pacific, for instance, where you see a lot more specifics used to sort of force traffic over particular paths. And, I get it. There's a lot of long haul expensive circuits out there that, maybe you want to use a different one that is more cost effective, et cetera. But it just means that it ends up sort of being a Wild West scenario where it's a free for all, both in terms of who's announcing what more specifics and how ISPs are handling, choosing to route those or not route those. And so I don't know. I think we're moving towards more stability in the V6 realm. But just sort of to add color around what Ed was just talking about, it's like, well, you certainly don't see, there isn't a reason to disaggregate just base that's built out of how IPv6 is. It's very similar to what we're doing with V4. But just basically accounting for all the strange policy and behavior that you'll see from any given network, any given downstream that's announcing routes to you, that, I don't know that we've seen we'll never see the sort of the boundaries of that in terms of what people actually do and how it's treated on the internet. So
I want to go back to your point about renumbering, Tom, because there might be some people listening to this who are thinking, how hard is renumbering? Come on. I mean, in my IPv4 world, I've got all my 1918 address space and it's NATed, and renumbering's a pain, but it's not that big a deal. Well, with a V6 deployment, I'm not NATing. You could, but generally speaking, you wouldn't NAT. You're assigning globally routable V6 addresses to all of your endpoints across your internal networks. You're not NATing. And so renumbering is actually a major, major consideration, not a mere inconvenience.
Yeah. I mean, you made the point. I just from a network operations standpoint, if you really have a lot of tools in place that make renumbering for your particular deployment easy, then that's great. I mean, my experience has sort of been all over the map in that regard. It's always been seen as something that's very onerous operationally, and something I'd rather have, myself or my team working on things that are much more interesting and provide more business value than having to renumber. But in the absence of NAT, maybe it's easier. There's the idea that because of some of the ways in which we can age out addressing in V6, that, certainly at the edge, renumbering is potentially less problematic. So I think it's a fair point in that regard. But in general, anything that reduces the amount of renumbering that I might have to do down the road, to extend the thought a little further related to just numbering into the space in the first place, when you're dealing with a greenfield deployment with IPv6, with your address plan, when you assign a particular prefix or subnet to a location or to an interface or whatever, if you do things right, there's a possibility that that's the last time anyone's ever going to assign a network prefix to that entity or that prefix or subnet rather, forever for that particular network deployment. That's not beyond the realm of possibility based on the amount of prefixes that are available and the amount of space that it gives you to work with. So you go from the idea of potentially having to renumber to never having to renumber, having a guarantee of never having to renumber outside of, some very, very, very different requirements than what your network is looking at today.
Here's another question related to provider independent space. That is public cloud. So if I have some number of services I'm hosting in public cloud, can I use my PA space up there in any way? Or am I relying on whatever I get from my public cloud provider and I have to rely on their address space because they're assigning their own out of their own blocks to whatever I might stand up in their cloud?
Yeah, this just came up. Ed and I were talking to a customer about this, and it absolutely the PI space there. And Ed, you can definitely please chime in here, but I think that the opportunity to bring your own IPv6 space to your cloud deployment is something that that's supported today.
Yeah, I mean that's already existing V4 today. V6 is on the roadmap for the public cloud providers, and I think what's interesting there, Ethan, to your point is, there's two different ways to tackle it. You can bring your own PI space, carve it out, and put a portion that's up in a public cloud, maybe AWS or Azure or wherever you're running your public cloud. And that's one technique. Or you could use the provider assigned address space that they're providing for the VNet or the VPC in AWS, and do it that way. And the real question is how clean does your routing want to be, right? Do you want to accept a PA block from the cloud provider and route that into your internal network to understand, especially if you're using with AWS, something like a direct connect link, right? Mm. Or especially circuit or with Azure Express Route. And you have those dedicated connections, you're going to have to accept those routes back into your network, but you're going to do that anyway, probably for direct connect and Express Route.
Yeah,
you're going to accept the address space anyway. So
you brought up a dimension to the problem that I actually hadn't considered when I posed it. Initially, I was thinking, well, will the cloud provider allow me to make this announcement to the public internet of some portion of my PI space? And I hadn't gotten further than that. But now you're bringing up the issue, right? If I've got Direct Connect, I've got other interesting routing that I've got to do anyway, whether it's PA space that I'm using up there in the public cloud, or if it's PA space that they've allocated to my VPC that I need to route across that direct connect.
It's going to look pretty much the same. It's address space that's owned by AWS, mm-hmm. and all their services are going to run. You can choose to just accept your own, or you can choose to accept pretty much everything they give you. It's all community based around, what region of the world you're in, et cetera, et cetera. So you get to sort of choose what you're going to do there. So pick your poison. But at this point, almost all of the cloud providers are probably going to extend the capabilities to bring your own address space as long as you're going to meet those minimum requirements. So for the DFZ, a 24 is what's required in V4. You're going to have to at least do a 48 in order to do that for V6. I would be surprised if you did something as small as a 48, to be honest. And Tom can pipe up on this one too. But when you're designing larger scale infrastructure, it doesn't seem to naturally make sense to go as small as a 48. You would carve a much bigger block to go ahead and
for the flexibility.
Yeah, how many VPCs do you want to operate? Right, how many regions do you want to operate in? You need to account for all of that, and you just want to keep your routing and prefix topology pretty simple. We've gone to several customers and said you need to plan for this in the future. It's not today, right? But just like with V6, you're having to think way further down the road. So maybe that service doesn't exist today for the cloud provider, but it's on the roadmap. You should take that into consideration in your design. And that's one of the great advantages of what Tom was talking about moving around those nibble boundaries, is the fact that that opens up space for you to go ahead and do things like this, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And for lack of a more sort of specific or ornate way to say it, I mean, just, you need to have a bunch of /48s lying around that you can just throw at these routing, these particular corner cases or routing policies that you need to support whatever your cloud deployment ends up being, whatever your IoT deployments you get into down the road. There's just all sorts of ways in which you have a sort of Swiss Army knife in the form of address space, routable address space in the form of /48 prefixes, as long as you've gotten a big enough allocation to begin with. Hmm. And as long as you've made sure that it's PI space. So again, it's like your particular network today, the size of it and how you size it out, it's definitely the exercise that you go through where you're realizing, well, I can justify getting this amount of space, but then sort of trying to look into the crystal ball a little bit and infer what your network is going to look like, 5 and 10 and 15 years down the road, and recognizing that, having a bunch of /48s available to use for what comes up in the cloud and IoT space is going to be really beneficial.
I got one more question that's kind of a big one, but I definitely want to get both your input since you guys have a lot of experience here. That is DDI. When it comes to V6, what should I be looking for in my IPAM solution, in my DNS, in my DHCP? Can you make any broad comments there about what I need to be asking my DDI vendor about, or features I should be looking for, things I should be thinking about considering DDI in the context of V6?
I would like to see DDI get to the place where I'm able to manage the objects that are consuming address space and using the address space resource as sort of objects that, you know, the tool allows me to see a V4 address, see a V6 address, and, you know, gives me that primary visibility, but then allows me to sort of manage that entity, that object, as just something that has, you know, a couple of different address families on it. I think there's still a fair amount of balkanization between the V4 and V6 functionality, where some of this is just related, again, it's back to that neighbor discovery change that we talked about in IPv6, where we don't have that in V4. We have DHCP that uses broadcast. Where a particular host lives, or a node in IPv6, and what that address is, it's easy when you have the single source of truth of a DHCP server. It's maybe not as easy if I haven't configured DHCP somewhere and addresses have been configured on nodes via Slack. And then how do I discover that? I have to actually go into a router or a switch, a layer 3 switch, and do a scrape of the neighbor discovery cache and figure out what those mappings are, figure out what the V6 address is in Slack, and figure out what the mappings are to the MAC address, because I'm doing a lot of, you know, MAC address managing of nodes or hosts via MAC address based on V4 practice that I do today. So, you know, I wish I had I wish I could report that problem had sort of been solved by the DDI vendors. There's definitely still some work that needs to be done to help manage the V6 space in that regard. There's definitely been progress on that front, but some of it is a chicken and egg problem in that you just don't have a lot of V6 deployment in enterprises, mm-hmm. where DDI is primarily deployed. And so, you know, that iterative cycle going with network operators realizing, hey, I need this feature and that feature, there's not a lot of that pressure yet coming from the enterprise operators, because early phases of V6.
We talked to lots of vendors about their products on packet pushers. And one of the questions I've gotten into the habit of asking routinely is, what is your V6 support currently? And although it's getting better, the most common answer I think we would hear, Drew, is, customers aren't really asking for that. So it's, you know, kind of buried in the roadmap. It is getting better, but right, that pressure from enterprise operators. Everyone out there, if you're running V6, make sure your vendors know you're looking for V6 support, so that they're hearing the message over and over again. And we're starting to get the feature parity that we should get between V4 and, mm-hmm. and V6.
Yeah, I think that's a great observation, in that they need that customer pressure at the vendors to really take IPv6 seriously. Because yeah, whenever we ask about IPv6, there is hemming and hawing.
Yeah, that answer of we're not getting asked about it from our customers. So if you've had the bizarre experience of being at a trade show, and there's various networking vendors, platform vendors, whoever it is, software, hardware, whatever it might be, and you're standing there next to a booth where you have an attendee come up and ask the representative of the vendor, hey, does your product support V6? No, it doesn't, because nobody's really asking for it. You know, well,
I just asked for it.
That person just asked for it. And then, you know, five minutes later, another person will come up and that same conversation will play out again. Hey, is there any V6 support? No one's really asking for it. Well, I'm standing next to this. It's like, I just heard two people in the span of 5 minutes ask you about V6. So, I tend to have a sort of jaundiced eye towards that claim from vendors. It's like, well, nobody's really asking for it. It's like, oh, okay, if you say so.
They should make that a field in their vendors, in their badge scanning. Came by the booth and asked about IPv6.
Yeah. Give them a sticker every time. But when they get the stack of stickers high enough that they can't see their name badge anymore, maybe they'll pay attention.
So, Tom, when I asked the initial question about DDI, you kind of made the point that, hey, we need as an industry dealing with DDI to get to a point where we're thinking about endpoints and the address families that are supported are just multiple fields attached to that object. But that's kind of not the way the world works right now. So
that's right.
All right, if the world doesn't work that way within the confines of the world that we do have, is there any insights you can offer about how to pick a DDI solution if V6 is important to me?
Well, you need obviously robust support for DHCP V6. And again, this is that issue where the deployments of DHCP V6 that you have today are either just as vanilla as they get, or they're super specific related to things like, you know, if I have a smart meter deployment where I'm expecting to be able to pass V6 options that, you know, the IETF has only just talked about recently, and does the vendor support that? So it's that due diligence that's incumbent upon the customer to figure out what is your deployment look like. If it's vanilla enterprise, the great news is that, you know, the support is generally there for DHCP V6 and how you want to run it. The bad news, of course, operationally is that, you know, DHCP V6 isn't going to help you in an environment where you have people bringing in Android devices and there's no DHCP V6 support. And so you have to run a parallel infrastructure of Slack to provide support for those. And then, of course, what the DDI solution looks like to try to stitch all that together is another question entirely. But that DHCP, the basic vanilla enterprise DHCP V6 support seems to be pretty good. And DNS, of course, there's even less to talk about that. And there's even less to talk about in that realm just because it's so straightforward in terms of what V6 DNS is. Now, all the bells and whistles around DNS security, which are obviously a big hinge point for a lot of the DDI vendors and the 800-pound gorilla in that space, you know, definitely is focused on security and, you know, how much of that security intelligence and vectoring is going on related to V6 DNS. You know, that's another question that you want to bring up depending on what your V6 deployment looks like. But there's a theme here that you probably hear emerging, which is like, it's like, what is your V6 deployment look like? You may have very specific requirements that other enterprises don't have. And I know in particular, when I worked for the big DDI vendor, we had customers that were at the bleeding edge of what they were doing, trying to do with V6 and asking for very specific support features related to, you know, the DDI vendor that has the grid that's always on and provides, you know, a incredible resiliency by having that grid. Well, does that grid run over IPv6 transport or is it V4 only? Right. Because, you know, the hack of just like, okay, whatever can't run over V6 will just run it over V4. Well, what if I want to get V4 off my network? You know, what if I only want to use V6 transport and basically tunnel all my IPv4 or figure out some other way to handle V4 as a service? Does my DDI vendor support that approach? And, you know, you really have to do your homework in that regard. But the basic functionality is there. Again, I still don't think we're at that point where, you know, we're effectively managing networks as objects that just happen to have a V6 and V4 address. All the operational benefit that would come from that, you know, is sort of remains to be seen. The other thing that I would take DDI vendors to task with, and this probably is not surprising, but, you know, hey, we've got this new way of doing IPv6 address planning. Give me a way to lay that out in the tool. Give me a way to build an address plan in the IPAM tool that I can just instantiate in my IPAM database. You know, it's some way of the simplified way that we're handling address planning based on using nibble boundaries and larger blocks of larger primary allocations, et cetera. I'd love to have a way not only to sort of have that, you know, in some sort of wizard or template fashion to sort of lay it out. And you know, I can do certain things today that make it easier, but there isn't just sort of that really visual approach to it, which I think would be great, not only in building the initial plan, but in seeing the results of that plan laid out in a really visually compelling and easy to understand way. So I don't see a lot of that. And again, I think it's just because, you know, there's so few people that are really clamoring for it, even though they should be. So if, you know, go tell your DDI vendor, hey, I want some V6 address planning functionality in the tool and I want it yesterday.
Well, thanks for that insight, Tom. I actually assumed you were going to tell me glorious things about how we were mature in this world and DDI was all caught up in V6. Oh yeah, we're set to go. The service providers have needed that for a long time. So we're good. Enterprises, good to go. And not so much. That's a bummer.
Huge gulf between what service providers require and enterprises require. And I think the operational maturity model, right, is not in play yet for the enterprise teams.
I worked at a service provider and can anyone say flat text file for managing IPs?
Spreadsheets don't work for those.
Hey, we would have loved to have had a spreadsheet.
If you could count in hex correctly for you for your address space, it'd be great.
I could edit my address plan using Ethan's favorite editor, Vim.
Vim did come up on Twitter today. It did indeed.
Too funny.
On that, you had a question, Ethan, that in the show notes that we put together ahead of time related to tools. And I will make a plug for a really just simple command line tool that I use to death, and I love it. It's called IPv6 Gen. It's just a little Perl script, and it allows you to do subnetting. And it's very configurable in that you can do subnetting from right to left, bitwise or nibblewise, or from left to right, or from middle out. So it supports I can't remember what RFC that is, that allows you to sort of carve up your V6 blocks, in any direction based on carving out nibbles or bits. And so it's really a great way to visualize, like have it spit out a group of prefixes based on, you know, which nibble you happen to be looking at or which block of bits you happen to be looking at. So I'll put a plugin for that free little tool.
That's IPv6 Gen, you said?
Yes.
Okay. So when you use IPv6 Gen and you try to do something bitwise instead of nibblewise, does the little guy pop up with you didn't do it right? No, don't do it.
It should. It's a tool from like 2006. It's really, and it doesn't conform to RFC. Oh gosh, what is it? 6724. Maybe that's the one that scolds you if you use uppercase letters for hexadecimal. Yes, it should be lowercase. You should be using, is it 6724?
No, 6724 is a host. It's
that's source address matters. Selection. Yeah. I can't remember what the RFC is, but it's not conformant with that RFC because I had to hack the script. So it used lowercase instead of uppercase hexadecimal. This is like nails on a chalkboard every time I looked at the output. It was making me sad.
Yeah, there it is. It's right out there on GitHub. If you do an IPv6 search for IPv6 Gen, github.com/Vladak/IPv6 Gen. And there it is. There's a documentation for it and explains it and change log and all the rest.
It's a great little tool. I'm filled with joy every time I use it.
And we'll put a link to it in the show notes too.
Absolutely. Well, that was my last question, guys. I really appreciate the time, Tom, that you took. You already took time on the VDC and then took yet more time to answer yet more questions about V6 addressing, which I don't know. You did literally write the book on it, but I got to think at some point you're like, when are we over this? I want to move on and do some other things. So I do really appreciate the time you took to talk through all these issues.
Yeah, happy to. It's my favorite topic to geek out on. So thanks for having me.
Well, unlike V6, we've run out of space for the podcast. So thanks to today's guests, Drew, Ethan, thanks so much for coming on. How can the audience actually follow you guys on the internet? You know, blogs, books, public appearances, not that Packet Pushers is a mystery for anyone listening to the show, but hey, put it in there anyway.
Yeah, for me, I'm on Twitter at EC Banks. I have a book, Computer Networking Problems and Solutions, that I wrote with Russ White. More accurately, Russ wrote most of it, and I got to hop on his coattails and contribute several chapters to that book. That's out there on Amazon. We're going to be live in New York City as the Packet Pushers, Drew, Greg Farrow, and myself. We're going to be there. When is that, Drew? It's May 14th.
May 14th.
Yeah.
Tuesday, May 14th, Times Square.
Yeah. And I'm at EC Banks, and Packet Pushers is at Packet Pushers.
And I'm Drew_CM on Twitter, and I blog at packetpushers.net.
Well, fantastic. You can reach the IPv6 Buzz podcast on Twitter at IPv6 Buzz. And you can also hit up the co-hosts. Tom is at IPv6 Tom, Scott's at Scott Hoog, and I'm at E. Horley. Thanks so much for listening to the IPv6 Buzz. You can find us on the Packet Pushers or any of your favorite podcast apps. Just search for IPv6 Buzz. And please check out all the other great technical content over at Packet Pushers at packetpushers.net. So long, and until next time, we'll see you on the internet. The IPv6 internet, that is.
Thanks for listening to IPv6 Buzz, a podcast devoted to truth, justice, and 128 bits of address space. IPv6.